This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Matt Doyle is producing. Signature support comes from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. We start our program today with Dr. William Bo Clark, third-term coroner for East Baton Rouge Parish, currently the president of the Louisiana State Coroners Association. And, of course, his job is immense at any time, but especially at this time. There are, of course, more and more cases of people dying of COVID-19. We've had a rash of homicides in our parish, and it's a time in which we are being tested as a people. And good morning to you, Dr. Clark.
Hey, good morning.
Opioid deaths as well. Why don't we start there before we get to the COVID-19 thing? You've been with us several times over the last many years talking about the spike in opioid deaths, and my impression, based on what I've read, is that they're higher than ever.
They are. I mean, actually, this year we've seen record-breaking numbers already, and we're only halfway through the year. I think, you know, certainly just because we are in the midst of a global pandemic, the thought that the opioid epidemic would disappear is not the case. I mean, it's actually proven to be just the opposite and gotten worse. In 2019, we saw a total of 128 overdose deaths in East Baton Rouge Parish. This year so far, to date, we have 112 confirmed with 21 pending. And so that's a total of 134 cases. Which will, you know, already beat last year's record, and we're only, you know, six, seven months through the year.
What do you attribute it to?
I'm not really sure. I mean, I think it's multifactorial, of course. All the things that we've attributed the opioid epidemic to previously still exist. Also the fact that I think up the chain of drug supply was hindered because of a lot of, you know, global travel and interstate travel ceased during the quarantine time of our pandemic, which meant that these drugs were being cut at a local level more aggressively. And we saw a trend in 2019 where there was a lot of heroin being mixed with fentanyl, making a very deadly cocktail. And that certainly has continued in 2020, where people think they're probably getting one drug or the other, ended up getting something way more powerful than their bodies used to. Mm-hmm. And obviously that puts them in a precarious situation for overdose.
877-217-5757 is your Talk Louisiana number. You can send an email to talk@talklouisiana.org. Dr. William Bo Clark, the coroner for East Baton Rouge Parish, is with us to talk about what's going on. And as far as people at this time being more vulnerable, those who have any kind of substance abuse issue, because of the uncertainty in our world, it would seem that maybe that might be contributing to it as well.
Sure, of course. I mean, there's tons of stressors that are going on right now with all the different things that we're facing as a country. Certainly, you know, a person who's struggling with substance abuse, maybe even the simple lack of support because medical clinics oftentimes were closed during the quarantine. Those all play a contributing role to, I think, what we're seeing.
What's the answer long term, or is there an answer?
Well, I think the answer is still the same, but one thing that's really interesting is as soon as the pandemic hit, the COVID pandemic hit, we really kind of stopped talking about opioids. We did that for a long period of time, and it was because it seemed to be that COVID was in the mainstream of the news cycle. And I think a lot of the awareness we've brought previously to the opioid epidemic has played a role in making people understand it so that they can also seek help for themselves or loved ones if necessary. So I think we got to continue to have that conversation when it comes to the opioid epidemic, as well as talking about the other things we do, such as the COVID pandemic, et cetera.
877-217-5757 and talk@talklouisiana.org to reach Dr. William Bo Clark, the coroner of East Baton Rouge Parish. And Tracy at the Capitol asks how the COVID deaths in East Baton Rouge Parish compare with the deaths from opioids, and you said as many as 134 people may have died from opioid addiction or misuse in this year. And The last number I saw for East Baton Rouge Parish, I think it's a little under 300 people have died of COVID-19. Is that basically where we are right now?
That's correct. As of this morning, it's 285 people that have died of COVID. All of these individuals had comorbidities, meaning they had diabetes, hypertension. Some were obese, certainly pulmonary diseases, possibly smokers. And so these things all played a contributing role to the death. Very early on, the deaths were coming at a very rapid rate. And I think because COVID was such a new or novel virus, everybody was kind of learning. We were learning what it was. We were learning how to treat it. We were learning who it affected the worst. And as we begin to develop that knowledge, we've actually done a better job at managing it. But it was very important that we quarantined at the very beginning of all this, so that we could stay ahead of it, and not fall behind, and certainly more people could have died.
Did I hear you say all of the cases in East Baton Rouge Parish are people who had some kind of underlying health condition? Every single one?
That's correct. That's correct. We only had one death. I had the death of a newborn infant that was not COVID positive, but the mother was COVID positive. That's classified as a COVID related death. Otherwise, everyone else had the traditional comorbidities that we've seen across the country and the world of people that get in compromising situations when infected with COVID. Now, you have to understand there are certainly, when you look at the infection rates, there are plenty of people that get COVID and then survive it. A lot of those folks, especially we see in our younger populations, may almost be asymptomatic when they get it. They don't even know they have it. They get tested, and all of a sudden they find out they're positive, and they didn't have they either had no symptoms or very, very mild symptoms. So certainly those comorbidities create a compromising situation for a patient when they get infected with COVID.
Well, it's comforting to know that for those who are in good shape and try hard to stay that way, that it can thwart this. You're saying that if you're not unhealthy, this shouldn't take you out and may be uncomfortable for a day or two or week or two, or you may never know it, but it's not likely to kill you. 285 deaths in East Baton Rouge Parish, and every single one of them, every one without exception, had some underlying health problem.
That's correct.
But the 285, when you put that in perspective with 134 people who've died of opioid addiction, and we're hardly talking about that anymore, that's a big number too.
Yeah. So we have globally seen the work of the coroner's office when it comes to our death investigation numbers go up. We've seen an increase in natural death numbers compared to last year. These are non-COVID natural death, and some of that could be attributed to a lack of access to health care during the quarantine phase of all this. Not really sure. We kind of have to see how that number plays out over the course of 12 months, not just 6 months. We have seen, an increase, like we said, of overdoses, increases in homicides. The only number that I've seen that has been down, thankfully, has been our suicide numbers have gone down. Certainly these are just preliminary numbers for 2020, but having said that, there's been an overwhelming number of death investigation cases that we've worked so far this year, so I would suspect at the end of the year we're going to break a lot of records compared to previous years.
Do you have the homicide numbers, Dr. Clark?
I don't have them right here in front of me. I apologize.
Well, it is based on what I've seen also headed for record territory, unfortunately.
Yeah. So we post those on our website. So it's just ebrcorner.com. So under the news tab, you can we update those pretty regularly.
877-217-5757. As far as the symptoms of COVID-19, as you say, most people who get it are not going to have any significant problems, but others obviously do. And some people who are in good shape, like State Representative Ted James, had a big battle with it, but he did have asthma, which is an underlying health condition. But what are the general symptoms that are almost universal, if there are any?
So the big three that we are looking for are fever, cough, and shortness of breath. And so, you know, and the other ones that you see are what we call less or minor symptoms. One of which is very telltale is the loss of taste and smell. And we believe that's because of the way the virus interacts with the nerves of our body that involve taste and smell. So that's kind of a telltale one in the sense that we don't know of many other viruses that actually affect taste and smell. So if you do seem to lose your taste and smell, I've even heard of instances that's the only symptom somebody had, and they end up being positive for COVID based on that symptom alone. But the ones we look for, of course, are cough, fever, and shortness of breath as being the big three because of the way they affect the respiratory system.
877-217-5757 and talk at talklouisiana.org to reach Dr. Bo Clark. We'll have another segment with him, the coroner for East Baton Rouge Parish for the last 8 years plus, and he has much to say about the uncertain world we're in back in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana on a glorious day in our community and in the state. Bo Clark, coroner for East Baton Rouge Parish, is with us. He's also president of the State Coroners Association. 877-217-5757. Chris in Westminster, you're on with Dr. Clark. Good morning, Chris.
Hey, good morning. I was just calling because I was surprised to hear the death toll being so low. And I personally know a couple of people that have gone through the COVID illness, and it's just a brutal illness that had them in the hospital for several days. It's hard to believe. I heard that that everyone has had comorbid symptoms and things like that, and I find it really hard to believe.
All right. Well, Dr. Clark, before you answer, Chris, most people in our community have one of these problems. Obviously, obesity affects more than half the people, and that's one of the problems right there. If we didn't have people who were out of shape, we wouldn't have that problem to some extent as far as people dying from this. But obesity causes, as we know, diabetes. It causes hypertension. And then people smoke. I don't want to answer the question for you, but Dr. Clark, you're saying that for the 285, that every single one of them had one of these issues, and that's telling.
Yes, and that's correct. And the one that I didn't add was, of course, age. We see a lot of folks that are up in their 70s, 80s, and 90s. And certainly once your body reaches that stage of life, sometimes it's challenging to fight any infection, and it just so happens that they get infected with COVID, but it could just as easily have been pneumonia, a urinary tract infection that causes sepsis, things like that that could have ended their life. But what you see is, you're right, in South Louisiana, in the south of the United States, there's a tremendous amount of comorbid health issues, and they're all intertwined and interrelated. Some of them, look at the greatest food in the world exists here in South Louisiana, and we consume quite a bit of it. So it does pose some challenges, even from a social perspective, of our health.
Well, I realize people want to take care of themselves, and for good reason, and not take chances, but to do it in lieu of getting any exercise, walking around your neighborhood, for example, that's an easy one. It's, if you get this, the better shape you're in, the better chance you have of surviving. So it would make sense that people get out and get some sunshine and exercise and get some sort of exposure to the outside world. Staying in all day is probably not a good idea.
Right. Or sitting at a desk, get up and move around is certainly important for our well-being, both physically and mentally.
877-217-5757, Mike in Villa Del Rey. Mike, you're on with Dr. Clark. Hi, Mike.
Hey, I'm proud to be a mass Nazi, okay? This may be out of the doctor's jurisdiction, but the school my kid goes to, she's 8 years old, they got 39 students, 8 teachers this year in one building. And I called to say she wasn't coming this year. And I was informed that we had already, 3 weeks before school, one teacher with the COVID, and five are being quarantined. Could the doctors speak on the schools? Thank you.
All right.
Yeah, I'm happy to. Of course, that you're right. That is not my jurisdiction, nor is any of decisions made about quarantine or masking or things of that nature. But I think you have to look at risk, and you divide that into true risk and relative risk. So if you are a normal, healthy person with no comorbidities, your chances of being detrimentally affected from catching the virus are fairly low. However, you can also spread the virus, so you have to take that in consideration if you're going to be around other people who may not have the same chance you do because they do have comorbidities. So I think it's all about relative risk. If you're going to stay at your house and it's a safe environment, you don't need to walk around your house with a mask, and I'm using that as an example. However, if you find yourself in a situation where you have comorbidities and you could be in an environment where you could catch it, then you might want to protect yourself, especially if you have to go there, like the grocery store, you have to get food. So I think it's all important to analyze the risk and what the risk is to all the individuals involved. Certainly children typically have zero to no comorbidities, so their chances of getting it are low, or getting it and detrimentally affecting them are low. But you also have to take into consideration the lady that serves lunch, or the janitorial staff, or the administrative staff, or the teachers. Maybe there's a teacher with diabetes or hypertension that could be affected adversely from it. So I think that, you know, it's just a matter of using some logic and practical practices to make those decisions.
AJ writes, we don't wear a mask. If you don't wear a mask, it's everyone around you is affected. You don't get to choose to drive drunk, do you? That's from AJ. LSU, by the way, Friday night released a detailed plan for its 2020 semester. Face coverings will be required on campus when it's not possible to stay 6 feet apart. And this is the interesting thing. No university events can have more than 100 people in attendance, and indoor meetings will be limited to 50% capacity. How can we do college football if we only have 100 people right. who can attend an event?
That would be interesting. I wonder who gets to go, right? I'm not sure. I'm not sure how that works. Certainly, not being in an enclosed environment, being outside, you're at less risk. But what is the threshold for less risk? Is it, 90,000 people in Tiger Stadium? I'm not sure.
David in Atlanta. Hi, David. You're on with Coroner Bo Clark. Good morning to you.
Good morning, gentlemen. Is it true, Coroner, from what I've heard and read, that children maybe are less likely to contract the virus, but they can have the virus and not show symptoms, but spread the virus when they go home to their parents and grandparents and teachers and custodian workers? Is there validity to that, Coroner?
Well, so the first part of your statement, is it true that they can't catch the virus? No, anybody can catch the virus. Anybody can catch any virus. Unless you have developed immunity either naturally, meaning you've had the virus previously and your body can fight it off, or you've developed immunity through vaccination. So they can catch it. What we see with the younger population is because they're typically very healthy, they don't have the same comorbidities we do as adults, such as hypertension and diabetes, that if and when they get infected, they show very minimal symptoms, meaning almost to the point where they may not recognize they have it. So certainly they're infected with it, they have it, but they're not showing outward symptoms. Therefore, they tend to more readily expose adults because we don't recognize it. It's invisible. And then, of course, if an adult who has comorbidities gets it, then they obviously feel the symptoms even worse.
Thank you, David. Christoph in South Baton Rouge. Hi, Christoph. You're on with Coroner Clark.
Hi. Good morning. We've been talking a little bit about who's been dying and who might contract it and survive. I've also been hearing reports about very healthy young people who get it and recover and then still have long-term problems afterwards. I was hoping the doctor could talk about that.
Right. So that is possible and true. Although not enough time has passed, because you got to remember this is a novel virus, meaning it's a new virus. We do not know what the long-term sequelae are going to be, and mainly what it will do to our respiratory and pulmonary system. Meaning, could you have a COVID pneumonia at a very young age, survive it, and then later on in life develop some kind of pulmonary fibrosis as a result of scarring that occurred way back when. So only time will tell what the long-term ramifications of this virus will be. But the good news is, of course, is as we move forward in time, things such as better ways to treat it as well as vaccinations will become available.
Well, we look forward to visiting with you again soon. It's obviously a story that will not go away. Another listener asks, have you been tested for COVID-19, Coroner?
I have not. I've not had any symptoms. I certainly have been exposed in the sense that I see and treat patients. I take care of deceased individuals. But we always wear the proper PPE equipment, N95 masks, et cetera. I have not had a need to get tested.
Well, stay safe. Thanks for your good work. Appreciate it, Dr. Bo Clark.
Thank you. Take care.
We'll be back after this 90-second pause, actually 2-minute pause, with more Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is your number. And we're waiting on Donnie Wilkinson, pastor at Broadmoor United Methodist, to has a meeting regarding anti-racism, which, of course, is a big topic and a worthy topic, and Reverend Michael Waters is expected to be with him as well. The U.S. budget deficit grew to a record $864 billion in June. That's 1 month. 1 month as the federal government pumped huge sums of money into the economy to prop up workers and businesses that have been affected by the coronavirus. The deficit has ballooned to $3 trillion in the first 9 months of the 2020 fiscal year, and it's going up and away. By far the largest deficit in the history of this country, and it is a story that is not really being focused upon, but this president, Donald John Trump, is orchestrating the largest red ink explosion in the history of this country by far. And it is an issue. And the latest is that he's not comfortable with Dr. Anthony Fauci, who's become a national hero, and we wonder if Dr. Fauci will survive the year. But we are 15 weeks away from an election in 105 days. We will elect either a new president or Donald John Trump will be elected for another 4 years. The heftiest president since William Howard Taft, going against the oldest man to ever seek the office, Joseph Robinette Biden, will be 78 years old in November. The president turned 74 1 month ago today, collectively 152 years of wisdom, and probably about 500 pounds of weight, of which most of it would go to the incumbent. 877-217-5757 is your number, and Dr. Reverend Donnie Wilkinson is with us. Good morning to you, sir.
Good morning, sir. It's good to be with you, Jim.
Well,
thank
nice
you
to talk with you, and I know you have a Zoom meeting going on, and it's an important issue, as we know, one that is searing our country. We're now 7 weeks removed from the death of George Floyd, and that changed American life, but in Baton Rouge, we have, as a people, I think, responded mostly responsibly, but we have a long way to go when it comes to understanding each other and living with one another and doing so harmoniously. What are you trying to do at Broadmoor United Methodist?
Well, continuing our dedication to pursuing a just and equitable society for everyone who lives in our community. We are hosting a 9-week-long online course entitled Makes Me Want to Holler, Race in America. It's facilitated by Reverend Dr. Michael Waters, who is a pastor in the Dallas area and is also an adjunct professor at Perkins School of Theology at Southern Methodist University. And it is open to the community. And in fact, there's still time to register for it. And if anybody wanted to register for that, they can go to broadmoormethodist.org, find the link to register. And as a gift to those who are listening today, we have a promo code, WRKF, they can do, and they will be able to register for a discounted rate.
And how long is this going to continue?
Yeah, the course is 9 weeks in total, 1 hour each Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock. We had the first session on this past Sunday, and if people go to the Facebook event page that we have set up for Make Me Want to Holler, they can find the video from this past Sunday and get a glimpse of what it's going to be about, and learn things that they've never learned before. I've been intentionally studying the issue of race and American history, discovering parts of the history that, even though I was a history major, I was never exposed to. And in this past week, learned even more that had been there, but I had never seen before. And it's continuing to help challenge and shape us and grow us.
877-217-5757 if you'd like to join the conversation. And now we're also joined by the Reverend Michael Waters, who is part of this 9-week presentation. And good morning to you, Reverend Waters.
Good morning. Delighted to be with you. Good morning, Pastor Donnie, as well.
Good morning, sir.
Why don't you tell us a bit about your background, Reverend Waters?
Yes, well, I am, depending on how you break up the generations, I am a Generation X / millennial black man who has been shaped by many histories, the histories of my family, the history of the black church and the black American experience, particularly at this critical juncture in the post-civil rights era in which we live in America. I have been blessed to engage in the study of movement and of justice and of racial justice in particular for many years now, first beginning really before my college career. I've always been fascinated by it, was drawn to it even as a high school student. Went on to Southern Methodist University, where I served in a number of capacities and studied race and history and faith, both on a bachelor's, master's, and doctoral level, and have since been blessed to return to my alma mater and other places to teach undergraduate, graduate, and doctoral classes on the same. And I'm still a student, still learning, still growing with those that I am honored to walk alongside.
How old are you, Dr. Waters?
I just turned 40.
All right. And you grew up where?
Texas. I'm a native Texan. Grew up between Dallas and Houston. Houston, I still claim as hometown. Mm-hmm. That was my coming of age.
Well, in your 40 years, I guess you were born in 1980. You're post-civil rights legislation, but as we know, we still have immense issues in our country regarding race. How have you been affected by this?
Well, in a number of ways. My grandfather grew up in the, as he would say, in the fear of the Ku Klux Klan. Still one of the greatest men that I've ever known, who was almost lynched himself as a young black man working in Mississippi. And hearing the harrowing stories of his upbringing, really since the time I was a child, even to the point of his service in the NAACP when the Grand Dragon of the KKK visited him at his home because of his work in activism and threatened my grandfather and our family. My grandfather was determined not to quail to that fear and to that intimidation, to continue to stand and to work for justice and continue to do so from his years as an educator all the way to a county commissioner and county judge. And it's that legacy, that fearless legacy of standing up for what is right, standing up for righteousness and moving forward in the way of racial progress that really informs who I am and what I do. Even in the contemporary space, not only as a pastor, mm-hmm. professor, and author, but also an activist.
Well, in this year, we've had two black men who have changed the course of American history, almost certainly. Congressman James Clyburn, who endorsed Joe Biden when Biden was flat on his back and dead on arrival as far as his campaign, and that brought it to life, and now he is the overwhelming favorite to be the 46th American president, and George Floyd, who died 43 days ago. Who could have imagined this, Dr. Waters?
Well, in reality, there are a number of persons all across America who know that while our world's attention was on George Floyd in Minnesota, that there are countless George Floyds all across America and throughout the history of our nation. And I think that's the most troubling reality, is that while there are these moments in history where we focus on a salient moment, a watershed moment, and we are fixated on it and it moves forward our progress, the reality is what happened to George Floyd has happened to numerous individuals over countless generations. And that's a great tragedy. I'm reminded of that Freedom Summer when Cheney, Goodman, and Schwerner went missing, and the FBI began to look throughout Mississippi for those three men who they believed to already be dead. The history tells us that as they were looking for three men, they stumbled upon eight other bodies that they were not looking for. When Emmett Till was killed in the Delta of Mississippi, the persons there, and I've led a civil rights pilgrimage and continue to do so for over 15 years all across the Deep South, the persons who grew up in Glendora and all across the Delta will tell you there was nothing exceptional about Emmett Till. They were always pulling black bodies from the river. And so that's really the greater challenge for this conversation. You know, white supremacy comes with an enormous body count. And so while we've been fixated on George Floyd, and understandably so, because of his gruesome death, the greater tragedy is that there are many more persons whose names we don't even know to mourn. So we've got a lot of work to do. And, you know, Jim Clyburn, who is a member of the AME Church, longstanding congressman, obviously made a great impact upon the presidential election. But we must acknowledge that regardless of whether it has been a Democratic or Republican president, that the harms against black people in America really have not ceased. And so we really need, I believe, a true reconstruction moment in our nation. And prayerfully, we're at that time.
The symposium is Make Me Want to Holler, Race in America. And Reverend Wilkinson, Donnie Wilkinson, once again, can you tell our listeners how they can take part if they so choose?
Absolutely. There are a couple of ways they can find information. The easiest is to go to Broadmoor Methodist webpage, broadmoormethodist.org. Click on the link, and it'll take you to the Eventbrite registration page. And for listeners who register today and use the promo code WRKF, they can register for the remainder of the course at a discounted rate. You can also go to the Broadmoor's Facebook page and click on the Makes Me Want to Holler event page.
Well, thank you, Dr. Michael Waters and Reverend Donnie Wilkinson. Good luck, and let's talk again soon. We're back after this pause. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Matt Doyle is producing. Ace Atkins is on deck, one of the fabulous writers in America, and he is a Southerner who is an institution now, as he just turned 50 years old, and we'll hear from him in a moment. But we do want to note that we understand Attorney General Jeff Landry has tested positive for COVID-19, and we wish him well. And if you heard Bo Clark earlier, and I'm sure most of you did, the coroner saying that people with underlying conditions are the ones who are going down and dying on this. All 285 souls who have been lost in East Baton Rouge Parish, Coroner Clark says, had some sort of underlying condition. Well, Jeff Landry is a politician who appears to be in very good shape, so he should be fine. We wish him well and his family. And this afternoon at 3 o'clock, the governor of Louisiana, John Bel Edwards, who will be with us tomorrow at 2 p.m. for his monthly program, Ask the Governor, will be with the Vice President of the United States, Mike Pence. They will be at Tiger Stadium. 877-217-5757. And speaking of Tiger Stadium, Ace Atkins is no stranger. Good morning to you, Ace Atkins.
Hey, good morning, Jim. How are you?
I'm doing well, and I think your backstory is always compelling. Not many fabulous novelists were star players in the Southeastern Conference, but you were, and not only a star player, you played on a team that, had, like the LSU Tigers of 2019, didn't lose a game.
You know, it's funny. I wouldn't necessarily say I was a star player. I was a member of the team, and I played. And I have very fond memories of playing at Tiger Stadium back in, gosh, I guess that was 1993. And that was a big game, but I remember the stadium very mm-hmm. well. What a legendary place.
And it was a rout. Auburn beat the hell out of LSU in 1993.
I didn't say that, but if you want to bring it up, yes, it was a good victory.
It wasn't even close. That was during the third year of Curly Hallman's 16-28 tenure. He won 16 games in 4 years. Coach O won 15 games in 1 year last year. But Ace Atkins was part of a team that went 11-0 in 1993 for Auburn. Yeah. And he now lives in an SEC town, Oxford, Mississippi. A great literary town, isn't it?
It is. I mean, that's what brought me here. You know, people ask, you know, I'm originally from Alabama and I went to Auburn, and how did I end up here at Ole Miss? And it's a great literary community. I'm fortunate to live here with a lot of terrific nationally known writers. Of course, it's the hometown of William Faulkner and home of also Square Books, which is one of the great independent bookstores in the country. So it's a real literary hub, and specifically a Southern literary hub. So I've enjoyed living here for the last 20 years, and it's a good place to be.
And at 50 years old, and he just made it a few days ago, Ace is the author of 26 books.
You're getting all my secrets.
26 books. 26, including 10 Quinn Colson novels and 8 New York Times best-selling novels. And you're back in a huge way with another one that is bound to be a bestseller that already has gotten exceptional notes. The New York Times says Ace Atkins' Killing Honesty sets a new standard for Southern crime novels. This one's called The Revelators. Tell us about The Revelators.
Well, it's funny when I talk to people that are from outside the South. You know, one of the questions I get is, you know, why the South? Why are you not writing about New York? Why aren't you writing about California? What's the attraction of writing about the Deep South? And, you know, for me, I love this is the area where I was born. This is the area where I live. There's just a lot of rich ideas and things to explore. And for The Revelators, it's really 10 years in the making, these 10 Quinn Colson books that have kind of been building onto, you have a hero like Quinn Colson taking on a criminal empire. And, of course, your listeners in Louisiana and, of course, where I am right now in Mississippi, we're no strangers to corruption within government. And so we have in the Revelators, Quinn is facing a very, very corrupt sitting governor who's connected to a criminal enterprise that's in North Mississippi. So it's just a rich area to write about, and I'm very fortunate to be able to write about one character and his family and his world for 10 books.
Well, when did you know you had something when this Quinn Colson concept came about? When did you know that this was what was going to make you world famous?
Well, I don't know. I'm still working on the world famous part. Hopefully someday. But for me right now, you know, I think the success of the series with its longevity, there's a lot of series that you see that'll start and last for a few books. But to be able to write 10 books is really based on the strength of being able to have readers come back and want to return to this world. And the way that the series came about was, you know, I was talking to my editor, and that previous to this, I had been writing true crime books. They were novels that were based on actual things that had happened. I wrote a book about Machine Gun Kelly. I wrote a book about Phoenix City, Alabama, that was the most corrupt town in the 1950s. And so what we talked about was having a reoccurring character that is much in the way that you have, you know, C.J. Box writes about Wyoming, or Robert Craze writes about Los Angeles, or John Sanford up in Minnesota. You know, to have a place that the readers can come back to and get familiar with. And, of course, for me, there was a no-brainer, and that was the Deep South. And I wanted to write about, I wanted to write about Mississippi. I wanted to write about Memphis. I wanted to write about this world. So that's how Quinn came about, was it was first really kind of deciding on the region that I was going to explore, and then I wanted to create a character who was very true to that world.
Well, and there's not only Quinn in The Revelators, there's his sister Caddy, and there is his wife Maggie. Tell us about the prominent females in the book.
Sure. I mean, you know, I think that it may be, for people who don't know the series, maybe a little bit misleading when they see the cover and there's a guy on the front of the book, you know, that it's all about Quinn Colson and it's all about him being the hero and there's nobody, you know, that shares the stage. But it's really a novel that's about this place, Tippahaw County. And in that world, he certainly, shares the stage not only with his wife, who's very, very important to the fabric of the whole series, but also his sister. And his sister is a very interesting character for me to write about. I mean, in Louisiana, you know, your listeners are no strangers to, you know, we see a lot of hucksters in religion, and we see a lot of people that make money and profit from it. I mean, here in Mississippi, we saw there was a faith-based organization that embezzled millions and millions of dollars from the government to line their own pockets. And so we get kind of a jaundiced eye when it comes to people that supposedly are people of faith doing the right thing. And Caddy is one of those people who really is doing the right thing. She's really living the life. She's doing outreach in her own backyard in this rural community, helping people get food and clothed. She's helping an immigrant community. She's really dedicated her whole life to kind of helping these people. There's one character who refers to her kind of as a cross between Mother Teresa and Loretta Lynn. And I think that's probably pretty accurate for who she is.
And then there's Fanny Hathcock.
And Fanny Hathcock is the other side of that coin. I think Fanny Hathcock has a backstory that goes not only to the Mississippi Gulf Coast and Biloxi, but also to New Orleans as well. She's somebody who would be very at home in a strip club over on Bourbon Street and working that kind of trade. And this is one of those places that, you know, your listeners would have been very familiar with as you're driving on the highways of the Deep South and you see a topless bar on the side of the road next to a gas station, and you think, who the hell is working in that place and what are they doing? You know, who ends up there? And Fanny Hathcock is the one who runs that kind of organization, and she's over the books become quite powerful and successful woman.
Well, for those unfamiliar, Ace began his career as a working journalist, and you were a Pulitzer Prize nominee for a feature story that you wrote with the Tampa Tribune. How did you evolve from a reporter into this accomplished novelist that we know?
Well, I always wanted, the end game for me was always getting to the point of writing books, and I always wanted to write books. And when I was in college, and I really kind of fell into, very fortunate, into the world of journalism. It was a way that I got into, get a job and making money. And also many of the writers who I really respected, you know, most notably somebody like Ernest Hemingway, you know, always said spend time in the newsroom. And that's where you get to get real life experience. That's where you get to, you know, hang out with criminals or cops or see real world stuff. That's the best experience you can get. And so I took that very seriously. But I knew at some point I would be leaving the newsroom and get into writing books. But that experience back in the 1990s up until 2000 was just invaluable for me. So I go from, you know, playing football in college to, you know, working in the newsroom, and then from that point transitioning to become an author. But it was really all about, you know, being around real people and, getting to have real experiences, and very proud to be a journalist. That was some of the best years of my life, getting to work in that newsroom.
How have you been affected by this COVID age?
Well, you know, I'm very lucky. My family has the fortune, both my wife and I can work from home. Of course, I'm a writer, so I can, you know, my trade is on a laptop. I can work anywhere. My worry goes out to people that are on the front lines that don't have an option where they have to go to work and they have to be around people. Here in the community of Oxford, Mississippi, which, of course, where Ole Miss is, we're seeing the town square affected. I have friends that are in the restaurant business. I have friends of mine that are musicians, and that's where, it's really hitting everybody very hard. We're fortunate. We're, of course, being very careful with this thing. We're, absolutely, I tell people, Quinn Colson would wear a mask. Let's wear a mask. Let's be safe. We're taking very safe precautions here, taking it very seriously. And, but I do feel greatly for the people who don't have an option like I do, which is work from home.
Well, Ace Atkins is back. His latest work is The Revelators. We thank you for joining us. Congratulations on your continuing success. And at age 50, I have a feeling, Ace, you're just getting started.
Hey, thank you. I like hearing that. I appreciate that very much.
Appreciate it. See you soon. Signature support for Talk Louisiana comes from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. We're back tomorrow, same place, same time. Our leadoff guest tomorrow is slated to be none other than State Senator Cleo Fields, who is calling for the suspension of prep football for 2020. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned.